And every time you breathe out all the oxygen you have. And everything stops. Your heart, your lungs, and finally your brain. And everything you feel and wish and want to forget, it all just sinks. And then suddenly, you give it air again. I remember the first time it happened to me, I got so scared I wanted to call 911, but I didn't want to look like an idiot. And then over time, that's all I wanted, those 2 seconds of nothingness.
The actress Zendaya playing a drug-addicted teenager in the new HBO series Euphoria. The show is getting a lot of attention for its graphic portrayal of teen life. We'll talk about that later in the show. First, President Trump kicks off his re-election campaign tonight in Florida. That is a key battleground state. And last night, the president tweeted plans to remove, quote, millions of illegal aliens who have illicitly found their way into the United States, end quote. Beginning next week, he says. Well, Trump announced the plan, even though Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, does not typically announce enforcement operations beforehand in order to avoid tipping off people they want to detain. So how will ICE, which is already stretched pretty thin, actually enforce Trump's plan? Joining me now to talk about this is Ted Hessen. He covers immigration for Politico. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, he said the word millions of undocumented immigrants would be removed. Who is he talking about?
That's right. Well, he wasn't immediately clear as to who he was talking about. But there is a plan that ICE has considered that would target Central American families and older unaccompanied minors who have turned 18 and have what they call a final order of removal. And that essentially means they've exhausted their way to stay in the U.S. and a judge has ordered them deported. Now, that would not be millions of people. I mean, the people I've spoken with said that that number would be more in the thousands. But this is what the president has said, that he's planning on removing millions of what he said, illegal aliens.
Well, so you say there was a plan already in the works for this?
This idea was first floated about a year ago under former ICE director Tom Homan, who said during a hearing on the Hill that he planned to step up enforcement against families. But that plan never materialized, and it appeared that former immigration officials had put the brakes on it for some period of time. And as you may be aware, about 2 months ago, there was a shakeup in the Homeland Security Department here in Washington, and several top officials were removed, including former Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. And since then, it appears that the plan at least is back on the table or is under consideration. Several people have told us that that's what Trump was referencing here. But as I mentioned, that number most likely would not be millions of people. And beyond that, ICE wouldn't have the capacity to remove millions of people. They just don't have the resources and have never done anything of that scale in the past.
Right. So a lot of these resources have been redirected to the border to deal with this influx of migrants, right?
Well, the agency is already saying, ICE is already saying that they're stretched thin by being sent down to the border to help deal with people that are coming into the country now. And they've actually requested something in the range of $300 million in a supplemental budget request to increase detention of people. So it's not clear that if they're going to Congress and asking for more money for their current operations, how they would be able to do such a massive expansion of removals like this. And just one quick point of comparison is that in fiscal year 2018, ICE removed roughly 250,000 people. So this would be a major, major increase to do that even in a year's time.
Right. And these were not necessarily people in the interior of the country either, right, who are harder to find.
That's right. That's right. It's a mix of people. And what Trump is promising here appears to be people in the interior. And, you know, he's saying millions. And that just doesn't add up when you look at the numbers of removals in recent years. And the peak historical number actually came under former President Barack Obama back in fiscal year 2012, which was slightly more than 400,000 people.
Okay. So he said that this would happen next week. So today, what does that mean for immigration officials? Are they scrambling to try to figure out how to do that?
I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that the president's speaking at a rally tonight in Orlando, Florida. And as much as this is related, you know, there is a plan in the works to target families. You know, a tweet like this that says millions of people are going to be deported appears that it would be also something that could rally his supporters and his base. I wouldn't be surprised if he mentions it again there, if he uses hyperbolic language again when describing it. So I think you have to see this two ways, as both potential policies that he could move forward with and also a way to excite people that he thinks will turn out and vote for him in 2020.
And is this a definite talking point that actually does fire up his base? Are they excited to hear this as they were, you know, in 2016?
You know, we will see. I mean, I think there are different views of how immigration has played for him in elections. He certainly leaned into it in the 2016 election. Right before the 2018 midterm election, he returned to it again, and he floated a number of hardline immigration policies that didn't actually materialize, including a possible executive order to what he said to end birthright citizenship. But in that case, Republicans saw that they made gains in the Senate, but had losses in the House, and Democrats actually took back the House in 2018. So, you know, I think we'll have to see how it plays out in the coming election and whether he keeps turning to it as his core issue and his sort of, you know, his base issue.
Right. And then, of course, the wall hasn't been built, and that was something that really rallied his supporters. So I wonder if they're feeling a little disillusioned that the promises that he made in his first campaign haven't truly materialized yet.
Well, I think we'll have to see. And I think that's a good point you make about the wall not being built. But I mean, there are even more recent promises that he's made. I mean, just in the past few months, he's talked about closing down the U.S.-Mexico border and roughly a week later backed off that. He talked about putting tariffs onto Mexican goods coming into the U.S. Again, a little more than a week later, said he wasn't going to do that. And now, you know, we have this tweet saying he's going to deport millions of people starting next week. So I would say, you know, check in next week and see if he continues to want to keep moving forward with that one, too.
Okay. Ted Hessen covers immigration for Politico. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, well, immigrants who want to get rid of an accent, they find that that's not so easy. Technology, though, is here to help in the form of an app. It's being used to reduce accents, but does it work? We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Can't. Very good. Now, around the rocks, the rugged rascal ran.
Around the rocks, the rugged...
Rocks.
Around the rocks, the rugged rascal ran.
Very good.
Addiction coach from the classic movie Singing in the Rain. He's working with Don Lockwood, played by Gene Kelly there, as he prepares for his Moses Supposes number. Well, Los Angeles is filled with dialect coaches helping actors prepare for roles and maybe acquire or lose an accent for a role. But for people who are trying to mask their accents in real life and sound more American, there are now more possibilities than just a human. Artificial intelligence. One app called Elsa Speak is using AI to give people detailed feedback on their English pronunciation so that they can minimize their accents. Vu Van is the CEO and co-founder of Elsa Speak. She joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
How did you come up with this idea?
I was born and raised in Vietnam, and I had been learning English growing up. But it was when I moved to the U.S. for my MBA at Stanford that I realized, even though I could read and write really well, when I spoke English, people and my classmates and professors had a really hard time understanding me, and that really hurt my confidence. And I started drawing back because when I spoke, people always asked me to repeat multiple times. So I've started looking for so many different solutions in the market to see what was there that can help me improve my English pronunciation and reduce my accent so that people could understand me better. But there wasn't that many solutions out there, even though there's so many different English learning solutions, but most of them were focusing on helping you with your grammar, vocabulary, and reading and writing. And yet there's very few solutions that helps you with your speaking. So I started looking into YouTube and learning through Netflix, but it was a one-way learning. So I was really running into a wall about what else could I do to improve my English pronunciation and reduce my accent. And that's when I resorted to getting speech therapist to help me go into these learning experience by having a one-on-one lesson with them, getting them to listen to everything that I spoke and giving me the very detailed feedback about what's right and wrong in my pronunciation, and how do I fix it by moving my tongues, my lips, or changing my intonation and rhythm. But that solution is very costly. They usually charge about $200 an hour. So when I finished school and went on and worked in the consulting world, I had the same experience seeing all of my colleagues internationally coming here, having the same challenge. I believe that there must be some solution right now, leveraging the technology and AI and voice recognition technology that has really advanced in the last few years, and see how we can generate that same experience that I had with a speech therapist or a friend here, but make it a lot more accessible to people out there in the world. And that's where Elsa was born, by the end of 2015.
Okay, so on your app, someone would take an assessment test to see how accented their English is, and that person would get a score, right?
That's right.
And what is a score a Native American speaker would get? 100%?
So it depends. So in the app, what we use, we pick one accent in American English, and we call it the general American English or the neutral accent, and that's mostly Miss Western English. So that's the ground truth or the standard that we use in the app. So if you come from different parts of even within the US, you might have different accents, and so the score might be different. Now, there's not any better or worse or right or wrong, but it's just that the app is focusing on the Midwestern accent. So that's the standard.
But why are you focused on that as the standard?
So when we started building the company, we worked with a lot of experts in the field, including speech therapists. And the general expert advice we had from speech therapists is that they chose the Midwestern accent as a general American accent that is considered the most neutral accent in American English.
All right, I'm going to play some tape now because a few members of our team tried your assessment test.
I plan to arrive in late July and would love to take a really long train ride across the whole country.
I plan to arrive in late July and would love to take a really long train ride across the whole country.
I plan to arrive in late July and would love to take a really long train ride across the whole country.
Okay, so the first two are non-native English speakers. The third one is, but he got the lowest score of the three.
Now to the results.
Wow.
Okay, wait.
What?
Mine is
What?
91%.
What? Mine is 93?
What?
Mario, how
much? Mine says submit and continue again. I don't know. Oh, wait, no, here we go. 90%.
What?
You guys are better.
I thought I had.
How do you explain that?
I think when I listen to that, I can totally say who's the native one. In this assessment test, we focus a lot more on the pronunciation of every single sound to be very accurate. I think the first two focus a lot more on that. Usually, as you are very Native American, you kind of go much more sloppy on the sound, so you connect it a lot more and you go much more fluently, but also kind of not paying attention to every single pronunciation aspect of it. So it could be coming into place of why the score might be a little lower, even though overall you sound a lot more natural.
Right. And so that's part of it too, because part of having sounding like a native speaker is not sounding forced or stilted. It's trying to sound natural.
So the one thing that we are trying to do in the app is we really want to bring people's understandability to the highest standard possible. Whether you have an accent or not, that's not really the focus of the app per se, that we're trying to get you to a perfect American English. Now, the way how that score is being calculated is only focusing on the pronunciation of every single sound. We haven't incorporated the entire intonation and rhythm and the natural sound of your speech yet into that calculation. And the audience that we are targeting is those who are speaking and had a very hard time being understood by other people. And one big element of that is because their pronunciation of every single sound is not accurate, and that makes it very hard for people to understand them.
And what about you? Are you happy with how your accent has developed?
Yeah, so that's the other element of it is, again, we focus on the understandability of your speech, and going from where I am, for example, taking myself as a personal example, to get to the perfect American accent takes a lot more work, and it's also the motivation. Do I care enough to completely get rid of the accent? Because that's a next level of learning.
Well, the other thing is like, what is the goal? Because getting rid of an accent, that does get rid of some aspect of who you are. In a way, like when I hear your voice, I know that you're Vietnamese. So I have an instant idea of who you are, which is great.
Yeah, so that's why I said that we also try to tell our users that it's okay to have the accent. The goal of your speech is to be able to communicate confidently and clearly, and people can understand you. Once you get there, I think you are okay, and you don't have to spend another 10,000 hours on this accent anymore. Now, if your job requires you to be speaking perfect American accent, then you might have to do it because that's your motivation. Now, there's certain piece of the research that people say, if you speak English with a strong accent, it might get in the way of building your trust and credibility, because people will trust you 30% less if you speak English with a really strong accent.
I know, but isn't that a chicken and egg thing? You know, if you get rid of people having accents, then people aren't used to it, and then therefore they're more suspicious of it. But the more people who have accents, the more normal it becomes, and the less people will be fearful or discriminated against.
Yeah, so for me, I am in the camp of like, you don't have to get rid of your accent at all. And I'm a living proof of like, I work in this accent app and reducing your accent and improving your pronunciation. But even the way how we built the app, if you play each of the game, we said if you get to 80% score, you are good enough and you should move on, because we're not trying to get you to 100%.
All right. So it's okay to get to 80%. We're all good with 80%.
Yeah.
Phew, Mario, you're in the clear. All right. Vu Van, CEO and co-founder of Elsa Speak. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
So why is the Midwestern accent considered the standard American accent? And why is it nearly impossible to get rid of an accent after puberty? Well, to answer these and other questions, we're joined now by Lisa Davidson. She chairs the linguistics department at NYU. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, is there actually a neutral American accent?
Linguists don't like to think of it that way. So we generally believe that there are many, many accents within the United States, right? No matter where you come from, you have an accent. So if you're from New York, or if you're from Chicago or Los Angeles or wherever, there's going to be some kind of regional accent that you will speak. That said, of course, Americans are very mobile. So there's a lot of speakers who speak a variety of American English that isn't necessarily tied to a specific region, but it itself is also sort of an accent. So we don't like to think that, you know, there's any such thing as a true neutral accent or an accentless version of American English.
Okay, so we heard Mario, our engineer, who is a native English speaker, a few moments ago, and I just want to play a little clip of him speaking again.
Okay.
Nothing beats chilling by the beach with the summer heat. It will be hard to leave.
All right, so he scored lower than the non-native English speakers. Why do you think that is?
Well, if the app is trained on speakers who all sound very similar wherever they come from, whether it's the Midwest or wherever those speakers are from, so if the training set that the app uses is very homogenized, then anything that's a regional accent that deviates from that could potentially, you know, not do well on this app. So one thing I heard in that clip, for example, is I heard Mario say to instead of ta. I think it was to the beach instead of to the beach. And I played with the app a little bit, and that was one of the things that it's pretty sensitive to. So, for example, it would have picked up on that as something that was different from its trained voice.
Let's hear him again.
Nothing beats chilling by the beach with the summer heat. It will be hard to leave.
Uh-huh. I see. I hear that. To leave.
Oh, right. He says it will be hard to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What accent do you think that is, if you could categorize it?
Well, it sounds like it might be a Latino American English or a Chicano American English accent. I think it's pretty common in the LA area, for example.
Yeah. Bingo. Yeah. His parentage is Mexican. Although he was born here, but...
Yeah, sure. But his speech community where he lives, probably all the native speakers of American English sound pretty similar to him. So, of course, it's entirely natural that that would be his variant of American English, which, of course, might be very different from the American English spoken by, you know, non-Latino speakers in Los Angeles.
Like my accent.
For example.
Do you think I have a Los Angeles accent?
Not identifiably to me, but I don't... I mean... White speakers in Los Angeles probably aren't that different from white Western speakers in the Western United States in general.
So when people move here and try to learn English and try to minimize their accent, does that make English a more diversified language accent-wise, or the opposite? Does it become more homogenized?
I mean, I think it does diversify, right? So, I mean, in a place like Los Angeles or in a place like New York City where people probably encounter speakers from other places all the time. You know, it's not like all native, non-native speakers of American English all sound like each other. You know, they're affected by what their own native language is. So their variant of American English is going to sound like it has some relationship to their native language as well. So we know that whatever your first language is going to have a big effect on, you know, the way that you pronounce the sounds of your second language or whatever language you're learning. So I don't, yeah, it would be hard to homogenize under those circumstances, I think.
And so is it on us to accept people who have accents, or is it on the people who have accents to try to minimize them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, as an avid second language learner myself, and also somebody who studies phonetics and phonology, so the sounds of the world's languages, I mean, I think it's really important to learn about the sounds of the world's languages and to try to produce them. So I would never criticize anybody for wanting to improve their pronunciation of their second language. I think that's a really great goal. But at the same time, it's very difficult, even for really motivated and really well-trained people, to eradicate their second language accent altogether. And so I think it's kind of a two-way street, right? There also ought to be more recognition on the part of native speaking Americans, for whatever background that you come from, that people who are second language learners, that they're going to have some difficulties and that we should be more tolerant of that.
Why is it so hard to eradicate an accent after like 12 or 13 years old? What's happening in the brain that's preventing people from eradicating an accent in another language?
So there's an advantage to narrowing your ability to speak all the sounds of the world's languages, because it allows us to learn our native language as quickly as efficiently as possible. So when we're babies, right, up until about 1 year old or so, we can actually distinguish between all the sounds of the world's accents. So when we hear them, babies are able to distinguish sounds that adult speakers who don't speak a certain language have a lot of difficulty with. And you can learn them too, of course, up to about the age that you just mentioned. But I think the thinking is that if we retained the ability to learn and perceive and produce all the sounds of the world's languages, it actually would be harder for us to hone in on and form the categories for our native language that we need in order to perceive and produce as rapidly and efficiently as possible.
And so something in the brain says, stop learning this language, well, focus on your own. Is that basically it?
Well, I mean, it's not quite that, right? So it's more like, yeah, focus as much as you can on your own, and you're not getting the input that you need. So I think that's the other half of it, right? Is that if you're not getting the input that you need, like you need all of these years of input of your native language in order to learn the sounds and categories over time. And so if you're not getting that input, then when you're an adult and maybe you're learning in a second language classroom and you have your teacher and maybe you hear a couple of recordings, but in general, you're not speaking to people all day long and hearing sounds all day long.
But is it really impossible? Let's say you just immerse yourself in another language and you don't hear any other language. It's just 24/7 this foreign language. Is it really impossible to eradicate your accent in that language?
Well, I mean, I think we all know people who live in this country, right? And who probably don't speak so much with people from the language that they grew up in, and yet they still have foreign accents. So yes, they can, in general, you're going to get pretty good, right? You're going to get very, very good. But by and large, it's difficult to completely eradicate the accent. That said, of course, there are, you know, I don't know what the best term to call them is, super learners. I mean, that's not really it's not really a fair term to use, I guess. But there are certainly people who are especially gifted at this. They, you know, essentially sound native, even though they've learned language after the 12 or 13 year period. But it's not going to be a given that that's going to happen.
And I guess there are actors who can get rid of the accent momentarily, but not permanently.
Yeah. Yes. So there's a difference between, I think, memorizing lines and generating speech at the time that you're also trying to get the sounds right. So I think if you're trying to produce all of the aspects of language all at once, it's probably a more difficult task than if all you're doing is focusing on producing the sounds because the words have been given to you.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Lisa Davidson chairs the linguistics department at NYU.
Moses supposes his toes are roses, but Moses supposes a Romeo's twin. But Moses, he noses his toes on roses, as Moses supposes his toes to be.
Moses supposes his toes are roses,
Moses supposes erroneously.
Many by Moses,
Moses knows his toes on roses, as Moses supposes.
Ah, such a good one. Coming up, how bleak television shows about sad teenagers reflect real-life Gen Z.
So you have a generation that's reporting really high levels of stress related to things like mass shootings, rise in suicide rates, climate change and global warming. And this translates into a generation reporting poor mental health compared to older generations.
The TV Unfunhouse next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for our regular TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, today we're going to be talking about teenage dramas these days. Teen TV can be pretty bleak. There's a new HBO series, maybe you've heard of it, called Euphoria. It premiered over the weekend. It's gotten a lot of attention because it follows a troubled, very troubled high school student played by the former Disney star Zendaya, and she's just out of rehab.
I'd promise you, if I could be a different person, I would. Not because I want it, but because they do.
Also this weekend, another teen troubled drama called Trinkets aired on Netflix about high schoolers who are kleptomaniacs. And then, of course, 13 Reasons Why. Season 2 aired last month after a very controversial first season, which made teen suicide a talking point. Well, joining us to talk about all this is Judy Berman, TV critic for Time Magazine. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Well, first, let's talk about Euphoria. It really piles on a lot of shocking scenarios, from what I understand, including full frontal male nudity, multiple occasions, and on and on. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, it stars Zendaya. She's a 17-year-old straight out of rehab. So she's trying to reintegrate back into her life and her school. But at the same time, she has this long history of depression, and she really believes that she can't give up drugs, that she sort of needs them to maintain a status quo in her life. And then she makes friends with a new girl in town. She's a transgender girl who also has this sort of long history of being institutionalized, being misunderstood by family, being bullied. And there's kind of an ecosystem of other disturbed kids around them.
Is there anyone who's not disturbed in this?
I've only seen the first four episodes of it, but so far everyone has a pretty miserable story.
Wow.
And worldview.
So is this supposed to reflect modern teen life?
I think it is. You know, there are some truths in it that really do resonate. The fact that prescription drugs and opioids are a huge problem. the fact that, you know, mental health is both a huge problem and a huge issue of interest for teenagers right now. I know a lot of the controversy around the show has been around this full frontal male nudity. And in the show, it's treated in a way that makes you realize what level of exposure young people have to pornography on the internet.
Are teens watching these shows or are adults watching them?
Well, I think both. But for teens, you know, they're watching them. They're kind of mainlining them on Netflix. In the case of Riverdale, which wasn't a huge hit, and the first season went to Netflix, and kids just binged through the whole thing. So what's interesting about that is that they're getting sort of a really distilled version of the show and a really intense version of it. Mm-hmm. When you're binging a show, you're kind of living with it for the period that you're watching it.
And I guess that's also problematic when you consider a show like 13 Reasons Why. And there was a study that came out earlier this year that showed there was a correlation between that show and higher teenage suicide rates.
Yeah, which is kind of the nightmare, knowing that the influence is there. And especially, I think suicide is something that for teenagers, you have to think about how you're depicting it and how to avoid endorsing it, because kids who are vulnerable to that messaging can be really impressionable.
Yeah. Especially, as you say, if they're binge watching and just living mm-hmm. with it, it becomes their
Definitely.
Reality in a way.
Definitely. And, you know, binge watching in itself, it is an activity that if you're depressed, if you're isolated, it can occupy your mind for hours or days, and you don't get much contact with the outside world.
Well, Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Judy Berman. She's TV critic for Time Magazine. Okay, let's talk about this in real life with Dr. Vale Wright. She's a director of research and policy at the American Psychological Association. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just talked about this effect of binge watching and the study that came out that linked 13 Reasons Why to an uptick in teen suicide. Is that a major problem, do you think, psychologically for kids, binge watching this kind of TV, this really intense, dark fare?
Well, certainly the things that we watch and the things that we listen to can have an impact on our lives and how we live them. I think it's often a little too early to say definitively the role that binge watching is having on people, because it is a relatively new phenomenon. But it's certainly something that we need to be keeping our eyes on and using as a way to educate our youth about good coping skills.
Mm. Well, do you recommend that teens stop watching after a certain point? Like, is there a certain point where watching too much TV is actually bad for you, for your mental health?
I don't know that we have any studies that suggest that watching TV specifically, that there's a particular level that people should or should not watch. What we do know from some of the data that I've seen around 13 Reasons Why is that individuals that are already vulnerable, so maybe they have a pre-existing mental health condition, are at higher risk for negative affect when they watch these shows. So it's also really very individualized. There's also some other research that suggests that these types of shows can serve as a way to educate youth about these issues and engage them. So again, I think that the research just isn't quite as definitive as we would like it to be.
Well, let's take a little step back and look at this generation as a whole, if we can make some assumptions about them versus other generations. And this particular TV show, Euphoria, its lead character has OCD, anxiety, bipolar disorder. She's ingesting meds at a very young age and becomes an addict. How accurate is this a depiction of this generation?
Well, what we know from Generation Z is that they're reporting incredibly high levels of stress compared to other generations. And in particular, what they seem to be particularly impacted by are national issues. So you have a generation that's reporting really high levels of stress related to things like mass shootings, rise in suicide rates, climate change and global warming. And this translates into a generation reporting poorer mental health compared to older generations.
And then how does that manifest?
so that does manifest in, again, poor coping with stress. So, you know, poor coping can include substance use. It can include inactivity, isolation. These are the kinds of things we're worried about. And when they continue over time, or what we call chronic stress, that's when you start seeing really significant physical and mental health problems, such as depression and anxiety.
But when I think back to previous generations and what they have had to cope with, there were ample stressors. Just thinking about the 70s, for example, crime was higher, pollution, at least objectively here in Los Angeles, was worse. There was this fear of nuclear annihilation. You know, we're in the middle of the Cold War. There were high divorce rates. I mean, there were a lot of stressors on young people a generation or two ago. Did you not see the same levels of anxiety and stress then?
So I think when we try to unpack why is Generation Z experiencing such high levels of stress, it's really probably pretty complicated. One is there have been significant changes in technology, not just the use of social media, but also the use of smartphones and the way in which we take in information that is distinctly different than it was even 10, 20, 30 years ago. For example, when I was in school from the Midwest, we practiced tornado drills where you had to go in the hallway and duck your head. Kids these days practice active shooting drills. And then they see on TV these events actually happening in schools. So it's an incredibly different way that Generation Z is taking in information, the speed with which they receive information, and the graphic nature with which they receive information, which is just different than when most of us were growing up.
Yeah, so I guess it's very hard to tease out the sort of the level of threat, the objective level of threat from generation to generation versus the means of understanding it and the delivery mechanisms with which teens are becoming aware of it. So I guess in previous generations, you could tune out a lot of this if you didn't turn on the nightly news and just go about your day blissfully unaware that there was a Cold War brewing. But that now, with a smartphone in your hand, you're constantly aware of the news, if you want to be.
Exactly. We know that the majority of Americans have smartphones. Notifications are constantly going off throughout the day. And our results from our Stress in America survey suggest that those who report being constantly connected to their phones and or use a lot of social media report higher levels of stress. So we know that these forms of technology are actually increasing the stress of individuals.
So then I guess that brings us back to the beginning of this conversation. And TV shows like Euphoria, 13 Reasons Why, do they then increase that level of stress?
Again, it's likely pretty individualized, but it certainly has the possibility of raising that level of stress, particularly if they are consumed without any context or conversation. So again, most children or young adults report that when they watch these shows, they discuss it with their peers as opposed to an adult who maybe could provide a different perspective. And we also just know in general that younger adults have fewer coping skills. And so they historically always report higher levels of stress compared to older adults. And so when you have fewer coping skills and you're watching maybe some really negative depiction, it can be harder to figure out how to manage it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
That's Dr. Vale Wright, Director of Research and Policy at the American Psychological Association. All right, Steve Giudicakis is here now.
When I was a kid.
Yes. What scared you?
Remember? Well, I mean, obviously annihilation and nuclear war. We used to duck and cover whatever under our like that was going to help us in a nuclear war. But and we did the tornado drills as well. But and the big thing was having a payphone in high school. Do you remember that? Like being able to use the payphone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. God, I'm old. Anyway,
we'll have to explain what that is.
A payphone, exactly, where you inserted a coin and then the dial tone came on. Anyway, coming up on the show today, you mentioned, of course, President Trump's tweets, right, from hours ago about deporting millions of undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens, as he calls them. Today, we're going to talk about HUD and a housing proposal by the White House that would have people evicted if they are not citizens in public housing, right? And I'm not talking about people who are like on the lease, but also family members who are not citizens. they would be evicted from public housing. It has a lot of people scared all across Greater LA.
Okay, important story coming up at 1 o'clock on
you
Greater
bet.
LA.
All
Thank
right.
you, Steve. Coming up, how technology is trying to tame a ravenous raven population that's targeting tortoises. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Mojave Desert is in the middle of a tortoise crisis. Back in the 1990s, you could find maybe 200 tortoises in a square mile there. So a lot of them kind of ambling around very slowly. Well, now it's just maybe one or two. So from 200 down to one or two. There are lots of contributing factors for this decline of the desert tortoise, which is now a threatened species. But the reptile's prime nemesis is a bird. The common raven. And after trying many different methods to ward off the ravens, conservationists say they finally might have a solution, and the solution lies in another flying object, a drone. Louis Sahagan read about this in the LA Times, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, first, let's explain how we got to this point where the tortoises are severely threatened. Why did the decline happen so quickly?
The reason is a century ago, there were few, relatively few ravens in the Mojave Desert. And what happened, though, is with the encroachment of humans through development, ravens are omnivorous, and they followed the garbage and the roadkill. And their population has been exploding. It's currently growing at a rate of 2.5%. Per year, there are tens of thousands of ravens, and as one scientist said to me, half kidding, they regard soft-shelled baby tortoises as tortellini.
Oh, that's kind of sad. So the ravens feast on these tortellini, and that's
they
the problem.
Love them, yeah. And to the extent that in one instance, researchers counted 250 juvenile tortoise carcasses under a single nest.
Ooh.
Over a four-year period, and they probably hammered a lot more, a greater number than that.
Well, when you say hammer, what are you describing?
I'm talking about pecking through their shells.
Oh.
Ravens are able to peck through the shells of even 10-year-old tortoises because the carapace is not strong enough yet to withstand the hammering of the beaks.
Okay, so basically we're to blame because the ravens followed us.
Yes.
Now we're trying to fix it, and there have been lots of proposed solutions, none of which have worked, except maybe this one, this drone idea. Can you describe what it entails?
In recent years, wildlife officials have tried shooting, poisoning, and trapping ravens, which risk surviving ravens being able to teach subsequent generations how to avoid those problems. At the same time, power company workers have been on search and destroy missions, you know, with rakes and tools to knock nests out of towers. Nothing has worked. Oh, there was even a laser gun that was developed for the Marine Corps at 29 Palms because they have to protect the tortoises on their federal property. So this laser was originally designed to scare pirates off of freighters plying off the coast of Africa. But it turns out that the light is so bright, I mean, it poses a problem for human beings who look at that light for more than a few seconds.
Mm.
And the ravens, it didn't seem to have that much of an effect. This time, however, I think the ravens have met their match. And I think we're going to be soon seeing raven no-fly zones in increasing areas of the desert because the biologists who have developed this drone, which shoots high-powered streams of silicone oil, the viscosity of water, it smothers the egg. It makes it impossible for the transmission of oxygen through the shell. So it smothers the embryo, I should say.
Oh.
And so they have the address book of nearly every raven nests in the desert now, those scientists. So once they get approval, and it looks like they will, they can go very efficiently and just oil the eggs you know, in just about every nest in the Western Mojave.
So let's break it down. The drone, the small little flying drone, is equipped with this oil, the silicone-based oil, and it locates one of these nests in a crevice, let's say, in the rock formation out in the desert, and it hovers in front of the nest and sprays these eggs while the mom and dad raven are out looking for tortoises. And then that yeah. oil just kills the embryos inside the egg?
It does. They spray the egg. They've determined that the best time to spray the eggs is the second trimester, because if you spray them too soon, the adults, the parent ravens, realize that the eggs are dead, and then they eat them. If you spray later than 2 weeks, there's a chance that you're going to wind up with a baby raven hatching out of those eggs. So 2 weeks in or so is when they spray.
Well, I guess it seems like a lot of trouble. Why not just smash the eggs when you see them? I mean, why wait till the second trimester and all that?
First of all, you have to, ravens build large, clumsy nests out of sticks and furniture stuffing in some of the highest places imaginable in the desert, from the tops of transmission lines where they could cause power shortages, to billboard signs, to cliff faces, as you say, and getting human beings up to those locations to knock the nest down is dangerous. By the way, oiling eggs, it's not new. It has been used for some time to deal with Canadian geese, for example, which are like lawnmowers on golf courses, and also double-crested cormorants, which compete with trawlers for fish. The difference is, in those cases, those birds build nests on the ground. So the treatment involves finding a nest, picking the eggs up with your hand, oiling them, putting them back in the nest, and forgetting about it.
Are animal rights people a little miffed about this idea of smothering the embryos?
No. I talked to the heads of Audubon California, as well as the Humane Society of the United States, and they fully realize that what we have here is, you know, the ravens are just, there won't be any tortoises very soon unless something is done. It's a lopsided ecology now. And so the success of the ravens is coming at the expense of federally protected birds and wildlife. And so they are not opposed.
Okay, when are we going to see it play out? The Great Raven War.
Yeah, and, you know, let me say this about that. In research that was approved by the federal government, these same biologists have already oiled 525 raven eggs in 116 nests in areas designated as critical habitat for desert tortoises. So just right there, I mean, those embryos are not going to produce more ravens. So they're already chipping away at this, you know, vast population.
Okay. Never more, for those at least. Couldn't resist. Louisa Hagen, reporter for the LA Times, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Here with some feedback, Michelle Eloy.
Just some personal thoughts, really.
Are you Team Raven or Team Tortellini?
You know, my heart wants to be Team Tortellini because
they're defenseless.
Right. Who's going to argue against like tiny little defenseless
tortoises
which
are endangered species.
They're not endangered, but they're threatened.
Okay.
So they're not officially
officially, but on their way.
It's not looking good.
No.
It's not looking good for the
tiny
tortoise.
From 200 to 2? Yeah.
Right. That's bad. But at the same time, Darwin, survival of the fittest. I mean, they just need to get
They need to toughen up their shells.
Right.
Which they're trying to do.
I know. It
takes them some years to do that.
Right. I guess when it comes down to it, like, how can you argue against Team Turtle?
Exactly. Tortoise.
Difference. Sorry. There's a difference.
I know.
Anyway, we have a little bit of feedback. We asked listeners to weigh in on Euphoria, what they thought of the depiction of the Gen Z life now. Maltese Mama says that she agrees that many kids that were focused on national events and politics in the 70s experienced similar levels of stress as the kids depicted in Euphoria. But how many of them were diagnosed with OCD, ADHD, panic attacks, etc., and medicated at such a young age? Very concerning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So instead of being medicated, they were self-medicating.
I guess. I wasn't around for the 70s, and I'm also far beyond the Gen Zers now. So I'm somewhere in the middle.
So you're in the happy middle. No stress for your generation.
I mean, not that I... Yeah, you know, high school, I guess, wasn't... Certainly nothing to the likes of what, like, Euphoria is...
It is fiction. It's a drama.
Yeah. But yeah, whew. Gen Zers, we feel for you.
We do. Listening. Okay. All right, Michelle Aloy, thank you very much. As a Gen something-er, not a Z-er, but something else. Why? Okay, good. All right, I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.